Hi, this is Nicole Hansoff, editor of HPC Wire, with this week's HPC Wire Soundbite interview. Today we're going to be talking to Julian Borrell, who's a co-leader for Lawrence Berkeley National Lab's Computational Cosmology Center, and one of the investigators on the Planck Telescope Project, a joint collaboration between the European Space Agency and NASA that's aimed at detecting faint leftovers from the Big Bang. Hi, Julian.
Hi.
If you could, give us some details about the nature of your research and what you're seeking to discover and what it means for the field of cosmology in general.
So what I'm studying is something that we call the cosmic microwave background. So this is the radiation left over from the Big Bang. These are the photons created in the Big Bang that have been traveling through space since the Big Bang. And as the universe has expanded, they have cooled down. So they start out in the Big Bang phenomenally hot, unbelievably high temperatures, but the expansion has cooled them so that today they're at about 3 Kelvin. So these are very, very, very cold photons, and we measure them at microwave frequencies, hence the microwave part of cosmic microwave background. And these are the photons coming from behind all of the things that the rest of the astronomy and astrophysics community are looking for. So this is the wallpaper, whereas the rest of the field might be looking at the furniture. The extraordinary thing about these photons is that they've seen it all. They've passed through the entire history of the universe. So if we can measure them with sufficient precision and disentangle the imprint that the history of the universe has left on them, we can measure and analyze all aspects of the history of the universe. So this is an extraordinarily rich data set. The challenge is that not only are these photons very, very cold, but what we're really looking for is the variation in the temperature and increasingly in the polarization of these photons. And these variations are 1 part in a million to 1 part in a billion on this 3 Kelvin background. So we're looking for extraordinarily faint signals, and as a result have to gather extraordinarily large data sets just to have sufficient signal to noise to be able to extract the signals we're looking for.
Right. I imagine this creates something of a very large needle in a haystack sort of problem for you there.
Yes, it's been going that way for a very long time now. The CMB was accidentally discovered by Penzias and Wilson. And since that serendipitous discovery, there's been a long, long history of people looking with ever greater sensitivity to try and find ever fainter elements within the microwave background. So I've been working on this now since I came to Berkeley in 1996. And over that period, we've seen the size of the CMB datasets growing with Moore's Law. So I was working on the Maxima and the Boomerang balloon experiments in my early days, now moving to the Planck satellite. We already have next generation experiments, the polar bear experiment in the Atacama Desert in Chile, and other experiments being planned that will gather ever larger data sets. So we've seen the data sets growing with Moore's Law for the last 15 years. We can project them growing with Moore's Law for the next 15 years. So we're really having to sit on the leading and occasionally bleeding edge of high-performance computing simply to keep up with the data volumes that we're gathering.
Right. Can you give us a sense of how much data we're talking about?
Yeah, so for the Boomerang satellite back in about 2000, we were analyzing about 1 billion samples. For the Planck satellite now, we're analyzing about 1 trillion samples, and the next generation data sets that we're looking for, the next generation satellite, for instance, we'd be looking at something like 250 billion samples in 2025 to 2030 timescale. Now, as data sets go, that doesn't necessarily sound very large compared with something, like the Large Hadron Collider. The particular issue for us is that we are looking for the correlations in the data set. So we have to treat the entire data set as a single data object. There's no divide and conquer. We can't chop it up into little pieces and farm it out. In the sort of way that people do with accelerator data. We have to take the entire data set as a single data object, ingest the whole thing, and analyze it in one.
That's quite fascinating. So what supercomputers are being used for this project, and what does it take on the software, the hardware side to manage this?
So we've been using the supercomputers at NERSC, the DOE's flagship unclassified supercomputing center, for about the last 15 years. NERSC has been an incredibly supportive environment for us to work in. And so that's ranged from when we first started this work, it was a Cray T3E. We've gone through a variety of other systems, IBM systems, other Cray systems. Until now, I believe NERSC has just accepted the Edison supercomputer. So this is a new Cray that we have on the floor. And so that will be our new flagship compute system.
What are right now some of your biggest computational challenges? We'll leave the data side alone, but when it comes to just, crunching numbers, I mean, what's really the biggest challenge right now?
So it's the usual thing. It's we have these extraordinary machines on the floor, with unbelievable capability, provided you can deliver the data to the cores sufficiently quickly for the analysis to happen, to be able to exploit that capability. Now, back at the when I started doing this work, we were working on these smaller data sets. We could actually solve closed form solutions for the quantities we were trying to calculate, and so we could use packages like ScalarPak and just do very large dense linear algebra operations and solve the entire system. The nice thing, obviously, about that is that when you're doing dense linear algebra, you get lots of data reuse and you get very high computational efficiency. As the data sets have grown in size, we can no longer afford that kind of n cubed scaling. So now we have to use linear, at worst, log linear algorithms, and Monte Carlo to quantify our uncertainties and to capture the statistics of what's going on in the data. And of course, linear algorithms mean much less data reuse, so the computational efficiency has dropped significantly. So we've had to be focusing very much on how we extract as much efficiency as we can from these systems, how we can really deliver the data as fast as we can, how we get past the input-output bottleneck, how we get past the communication bottleneck, and how we really get to exploit the compute capability.
So, with all of those challenges in mind, are there any new tools or technologies, even those on the horizon, that you're looking toward as maybe future solutions to these problems?
Yeah, well, as I say, we see the data sets growing with Moore's law, so we're basically constrained to follow wherever the architectures take us. And obviously, we're at a period where the continuation of Moore's law is going to depend on some very significant architectural shifts, particularly in the context of constraints on the amount of power that we can put into the supercomputers. And so we're already looking at taking our core codes, the ones that really do the bulk of the heavy lifting, and porting those to GPU-based systems, porting them to the Intel Mic, and so looking at where these next architectures are going to take us. The challenge, of course, is not only are these more complicated systems to exploit, but it's not clear that they're going to be the generation beyond the next. And so there's this issue about, we know that we have data that we're going to need to analyze on next generation systems, but we're also going to have data that we're going to analyze on the generation after that and the generation after that. And as I say, we can see, 15 years in the future, we'll have 1,000 times the data volume. What will a state-of-the-art supercomputer look like in 15 years?
Right. And so you've already started the process of porting some of your applications over to, say, CUDA, or you've looked pretty intensely then at the MIC architecture. At what point are you in those explorations?
So we're really looking at the dominating computational kernels and how we can port those to these various architectures. And it's an interesting sort of balancing act between the technology and the practicality. We know that the cycles we're going to get are going to be on NERSC systems. So, where is NERSC in particular going in its architecture roadmap over the next few years? Obviously, the other systems are available, but in terms of the kinds of resources we have committed to, those are primarily located at NERSC. So, for example, there is a memorandum of understanding between NASA and Department of Energy that NERSC will provide computing for Planck for the lifetime of the Planck mission. So, you know, we're obviously surveying both the entire landscape of architectures that might be coming along, but also with a particular eye on, you know, where is NERSC going to be going with its next system and the system beyond and the system beyond.
Great. And are there any tools on the data side that you're looking at that might help you? I mean, you already mentioned that software tools that might slice and dice and then re-piece data back together a la Hadoop or MapReduce are not a good fit for something like this. Is there anything out there that you're looking to on the horizon?
Yeah. I mean, you're right. It is a particular challenge that doesn't decompose very well. So we have looked at some of the other languages that might address global address spaces, things like UPC. It turns out that our core computational kernel is specific and at its essence simple enough that if we can really just focus on that one piece, I think we can get a lot of the mileage. We've already abstracted away almost all of the I/O, and so replaced a lot of the I/O with recomputation of data. It turns out that ends up being much, much faster. We're working on different communication algorithms to try and minimize the overhead there. So there aren't any sort of out-of-the-box solutions that we know of, or that you know, this is obviously an area that many people are working in trying to address these kinds of challenges. The libraries can help us to some extent. So for instance, in moving over to running on GPUs, we've been looking at, you know, the core computation is an FFT, it's a fast Fourier transform. So we can look at things like the CUDA FFT libraries. On the other hand, we've still got to do the data movement back and forth between the CPU and the GPU. So maybe we want to actually push more than just the FFT onto the GPU, and then we're sort of talking about custom coding and not just library calls.
You're putting a lot of ideas into the vendors' heads, I hope, here, because these are not uncommon challenges.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, are a lot of these challenges the same that you hear from colleagues in different departments as they look at some of their large scale science projects?
Yes, absolutely, and that's actually one of the joys of being in a division like the computational research division here at the lab, because we have, you know, people working across a whole range of science fields, but a lot of us share similar kinds of issues, of course, so we get a lot of cross-fertilization of ideas and a lot of projects where, you know, if we can solve this in the general case, it will have immediate application across a wide range of data, not just in cosmology or not just in astrophysics, but into climate and materials and accelerators and all kinds of areas where we are heavily data dominated. And I'm loath to use the big data term. It's become, you know, it's the current buzz. We've always had big data. We're happy that big data is having a raised profile, because it's been a problem for us, again, for the last 15 years, and we can see it being a problem for the next 15 years. So anything that helps us address that is going to be good news.
It is kind of interesting to watch big businesses talk about their computational and data challenges in the same way that a lot of HPC folks do. I don't think that's ever happened, at least not to this degree, before.
Sure, yeah.
Okay. Well, Julian, it's been wonderful talking to you. We'll keep up with your work at NERSC, and thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.